by just saying, congratulations, you... No, no, it wasn't quite the message. So let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. When he saw that, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die and said, it is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's. Then as he lay and slept under a broom tree, suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, arise and eat. Then he looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals. When I read this earlier this week, I just couldn't help but think this was the first instance of an angel food cake. I know that was really bad, but I I talked about touched by an angel last time. Well, here we have angel food cake, and it really is there. Now, you can figure that out. Why didn't you think of that? Or where was I before I rudely interrupted myself? Verse 6, then he looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came back the second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he arose and ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, or Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. And there he went into a cave and spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? So he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. Now, last week, I know we looked at these same verses. I know that. I'm not having a senior moment that I have forgotten what we did last week. But I am critiquing what we did last week, because last week we kind of did what I call a hop, a skip, and a jump across the text. But we never quite settled down into the text. And I don't like that. I don't mind hopping and skipping and jumping. That wasn't your choice. That was my choice. So I'm only critiquing myself when I say this. But we didn't actually quite settle down and say, okay, what is this text really about? We just kind of thought about some things that were almost extras or tangents, some thoughts that this text kind of illustrated, but not really quite what the text was about. For example, the hop was, we talked about the tenderness of God. The fact that God treated Elijah with a tenderness here. He didn't scold him, even though the Lord knew precisely what was going on and why Elijah did what he did. The Lord didn't take him to task. He ministered to him with a sleep and an angel and so on. So we learned a little bit about the tenderness of God, and that was true. That was the hop, the skip. We talked about the toughness of life. Life is difficult. And I drew that from the words of the angel to Elijah when he touched him and woke him up. He says, the way is too great for you. This is hard. This is not easy. And in a broader scale, we took the time to say, the way is too great for any of us. When you think about the enemies that we face, the world, the flesh, the devil, a culture around us that is changing under our feet, when you think about the expectations that the Lord has of us, those expectations have not been lowered at all. They are right up there. And we can get ourselves pretty discouraged and weary trying to live up to all that. Yeah, the drag on the one side, an internal drag. The way is too great for you. It's too hard, and we really need the Lord. And we take comfort in that. So that was kind of the hop and the skip. And the jump was we talked about the truthfulness of Scripture, that here you have one of the heroes of the Old Testament and the New Testament and a model prophet, you know, and yet here he has this downtime, this problem, failure, if you will. And yet the Lord, in his word, doesn't hide that. He doesn't pretend like it didn't happen. You know, we get the whole story here. And that helps us to understand that what we read about in Scripture is really the truth. It's not just a kind of a book that has an agenda and you pass over things that are contrary to that agenda. No, it's the truth. And so that was kind of the hop and skip and the jump. And I really think that there are illustrations of that in the passage. But that's not what the passage is really all about. And so you kind of got to ask yourself, okay, what is this passage really about? And the answer to that question is this is about a godly man who had a moment of weakness. That's what these 11 verses are really all about. We're talking here about a godly man, Elijah, who knew the Lord and knew something of the Lord's word and his power, and he was a man with good spiritual experience, and yet he flubbed in a moment of weakness. That's what these verses and that's what this whole chapter is about, and that's what I really have to talk about. And I don't talk about this in a kind of a Pharisaical, hypocritical way, looking down my spiritual nose at Elijah and say, shame on you, you know, you had a moment of weakness. The true truth is, all of us have moments of weakness. And we need to admit that to ourselves. If we have problems admitting that to ourselves, then we're setting ourselves up for our own moment of weakness and our own flub. So I got to talk about that for just a little while tonight. That's really kind of the theme of tonight. And that's why I noticed your songs. Because I noticed this marvelous commission and responsibility that we have. And yet, on the other hand, you get this weakness here that, wow, you know, so appropriate to the text and appropriate to life itself. So we're reading about a man, a godly man, who had a moment of weakness. He, when I say that, I don't mean a moral failure. This is not a moral failure. There was no immorality here. There was no ethical failure here in terms of money or truthfulness or anything like that. This was a failure in his courage, which is a strange kind of a thing, because as you may recall, as we started this whole series, Elijah's great strength was his courage. He seemed to be afraid of nobody and nothing. I mean, would you stride into the throne room of the king of Israel and say, no rain until I say so. See you later. I don't think I would do that. I might write a letter, you know. Would you mind if there be no rain? I may not even sign the thing. I'm a chicken liver, let's face it. He was not afraid. Stand up there on Mount Carmel, 450 religious rivals there, the prophets of Baal, who seem to be in the ascendancy, and, you know, challenge them to a duel, a contest, and bingo, and you know what happened. It's like, wow, this guy is gutsy. And when, as I'll jump ahead here a moment, you talk about Naboth's vineyard and how, I just don't want to tell you the whole story, but, you know, he says, I want that vineyard, and Jezebel says, I'll get it for you. And she does, and Naboth is dead, and Ahab is there taking charge, and guess who shows up? Elijah. He says, hey, you. You have sinned. You're history, you know. He wasn't afraid of anything or anybody except right here. And it's kind of like, I didn't think you were going to have a failure in that area of your strength. Which leads me to say we need to be careful about our strengths. You may think, oh, you know, I would never. I've got this area of life. Wow. Wherefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. The danger there is not just in falling. The danger is in thinking incorrectly that, you know, I really can't fall in that area. I've got that one down. I would never. Oh, boy. Be careful. The other thing that's kind of interesting, at least to me, is that this moment of weakness is kind of such a shock because it comes after such a victory, doesn't it? I mean, this is like the next day. And you say, hey, you know, you had this marvelous victory on Mount Carmel, and the people fell on their faces and they shouted, Jehovah is the Lord, Jehovah, you know, and it's like, woo, we won and you guys lost. And he didn't even have time to gloat about it because he went from the top to the bottom just like that. And maybe I shouldn't be surprised because every mountain has a valley on both sides. And you and I can have a real good day, you know, a real victorious day, and then plummet the next into despair, etc. So maybe I shouldn't be so surprised. I've worked for pastors and churches for a long time, and they tell me that, you know, the day of the week that most pastors write their resignation is Monday. You can have a wonderful day on Sunday, and then Monday you plunge into depression. I can understand that. So, but that is really what's going on here. Here's a godly man caught in a moment of weakness, and he fails. He fails in the area of his greatest strength, which is courage. So that's one thought. Here's a second thought, and I hope these one leads to the other. Why in the world was he so weak? What were the factors that contributed to his weakness? And I think these are important for you and I need to be alert and aware. Because whatever contributed to Elijah's weakness could also contribute to ours. I think it's a no-brainer to begin and say, you know, he was worn out physically. He was just worn out. A lot of reasons why he was worn out, but he was worn out. And I think that you and I can get worn out too. I'm not sure exactly where to go with that because each of us has a different level of physical energy. But I think of him kind of being under the gun for some 3.5 years. I lightheartedly quipped about, you know, striding into the king's throne room there and just giving him an order and so on. But then remember, after doing that, he had to go into hiding in two different places. He was in hiding there at the brook Cherith until it dried up, and then on over to the Gentile city of Zarephath until really the end here. He had to be in hiding for 3.5 years, that's wearing on a person. You get pretty tired, kind of looking over your shoulder and wondering who's gonna know or who knows is gonna tell, and you know, all of that, how this is all gonna turn out. I think there was a certain, I use the word physical, but I think there was also a certain amount of emotional weariness here. The word we use today is the word stress. And there were lots of stressors here. This whole idea of living in hiding for some 3.5 years. And it's interesting when you read about that encounter with Obadiah. Obadiah reminds him, hey, you know, Ahab's been looking for you all over the place. And he's been serious about looking for you. And that would have given him another little clue. You know, hey, you know, this is pretty serious, and I'm a wanted man. And all of that kind of wears on a person, it seems to me. Also, it seems to me that when you are involved in a confrontational kind of ministry or relationship where you are constantly, it would appear, you are at odds. There's an adversarialness in what you do. That can really wear you down. Am I making any sense to you? You understand? Even in our, I mean, just think about it. Even between a husband and a wife, if there's an adversarial thing going on between a husband and a wife, I mean, that can just wear you out. Or do that in a family with your children, even adult children, you know, and they're saying and you're saying and there's a disagreement and that thing goes on very long. It's like, good night, I'm just worn out, physically worn out from the stress of that controversy, etc. So he had been doing that for 3 good years. Whoa. Then this one may not seem quite so. I mean, this is very obvious to me anyway. Remember at the end of that Mount Carmel experience and the coming of the rain and so on, remember that he was especially empowered to run in front of that chariot from Mount Carmel to Jezreel, the summer palace of Ahab and Jezebel. Now, I've read different commentaries on that, and the estimates are between 18 miles, the shortest, to 26 miles, the longest. So if you bring that into our day, a 26-mile run is a marathon. I've never run a marathon in my life. I've watched it. My daughter and son-in-law run marathons. I think they're absolutely crazy, but they, you know, and et cetera. But can you imagine, especially if you didn't train for it, and then all of a sudden, in one day, here you are running 26 miles, and the next day someone said, you're dead. And you imagine the physical exhaustion just from that alone. So that's kind of my answer to the question, why in the world did he have this moment of weakness? There was a physical dimension to it. There was an emotional dimension to it. And I'm going to mention one other, which may at first not seem to be there, but as you keep reading, you kind of think, I think it's there. And that is simply what I'm going to call aloneness. Aloneness. Because everything that Elijah had done up to this point, it would appear at least, is that he was all alone. There wasn't a partner. It does talk here about a servant that he releases to there in Beersheba. But before that, we have no clue that he was with anybody, really. And he was carrying all of this heaviness by himself. He was alone in it, it would appear. And that, I'm saying this because I know the rest of the chapter. That aloneness seemed to be a deficiency. It seemed to contribute to the fatigue and the exhaustion that he was feeling. And I hope I'm not making too much of that. But, you know, later on when the Lord says, hey, what are you doing here anyway? And you know what he said. He says, you know, I'm the only guy left. It was an exaggeration. It wasn't true, as we'll see in a moment. But he felt all alone. Or I should put it this way. Because he was all alone, he felt lonely. I guess there's a difference between aloneness and feeling lonely. But he was actually doing the work of the Lord alone. And I think that that had a way of skewing his perspective on who he was and what was going on and what the Lord was doing, etc. And I say that to you probably, just to be honest about it, I probably say that to you because of my experience in the last 18 years, being out and about among our churches and trying to encourage people to community, to, hey, you're not alone. You're independent Baptist, but you don't have to be isolated. Come on. And you don't have to be afraid of each other. You know, it's like, you know, they are people of the same. They believe the same doctrinal commitments that you believe. And they didn't listen to me. I finally quit. You know, I'm just teasing. But I think I've preached the same message for 18 years, you know. Pat used to say, we specialize in looseness, just being loose and not be connected to anybody. But I think all of those factors taken together, he was just at a very low ebb in many ways. And I guess we could go a long way down, but I don't want to do that. I guess I want to say to you, my friends, be sure you get enough sleep. Just to be very simple about it. You know, don't just think you're some kind of a super person who doesn't need a good night's rest. And food, you know, you notice what the Lord did here. It was sleep and food. Well, eat right. Eat right. Take good care of this thing. You know, this is, you only get one. You only get one. You know, take it to McDonald's. Take it to Burger King. Take it to Taco Bell. I mean, take it to good places. Are you out there? I mean, are anybody listening? I mean, nobody want to object? I mean, come on. I'm just saying, get some rest and take good care of your body. Take some walks. Do some exercise, you know. And rightly, you know, come to church and fellowship with God's people and come to Young at Heart and, you know, you don't have to be a loner. You know, just anyway, we're looking at a godly man who had a moment of weakness. Secondly, that weakness came from varying causes, from multiple, a complex of causes, if you will. Third, the result. What is the result of this weakness? What did it? How did it come out here in Elijah? Well, I've already hinted at it, but I'll just say it. He had a skewed perspective on reality. A skewed perspective on reality. It's almost laughable in a way when he says, "It is enough. Take my life. I'm ready to die." That was not true. Had he been ready to die, all he had to do was stay where he was. And Jezebel would have taken care of it. But he wasn't ready to die. He scrammed out of there, as you know, 85 miles south, and then another day into the wilderness before he even said, "I'm ready to die." Hey, you know what? You're not ready to die. Come on, be realistic here. You got a skewed view of reality. I won't go there where I want to go. I'm not going there. But I just want to tell you that when you get tired, when you get down and depressed and so on, it's like you can't think straight. How's that? You don't think straight. And that's why it's better probably to get a good night's sleep and have a good meal before you make any kind of a major decision. You say, "Warren, you're meddling now. You're not preaching." I am preaching, actually. But I just can't help but chuckle at him when he says, "I'm ready to die." I say, "Well, if you're ready to die, just stay where you were." and you would have been fine. Same thing with Jonah. I was thinking about that because Jonah said a similar thing. You know, he says, you know, I'm ready to die. I don't want to live anymore. Elijah said it because he was so discouraged and down. Jonah said it because he was so angry. How in the world could you forgive those people? I knew going in you're going to be gracious and forgive them. Nuts. I'd just soon die than see them forgiven. He didn't really mean it. Because when he woke up in the belly of that fish a few days before, he was saying, oh, thank you, I'm still alive. I mean, if you want it so ready to die, just stay there in the fish. Thank you very much. That's what I mean.
This morning in Sunday school, we were talking, and Larry Smith said, if he really wanted to die, why didn't he just jump off the boat instead of being thrown in?
Exactly. Same idea. You know, you were in the middle of a storm. Just go for it. Yeah. Well, when we say, you know, I'm ready to die, we really don't mean it. But because of our weariness and our skewing of our understanding of reality, we just say stupid things. And we probably entertain stupid ideas. I didn't know you were talking about Jonah this morning. I'm glad to know that there was some connection there. So we have a little bit of skewing of his understanding of what in the world's going on. Also, I think part of the... I read this, so it's not original with me, but I like the thought. When you're so down and so tired in a moment of weakness, you tend to magnify the negatives and you tend to minimize the positives. And we all do this. I do this. It's, you know, he magnified the problem when he says, they seek my life. Now, wait a minute. Who's seeking your life, Elijah? He gives the impression that all of Israel was seeking his life. No, there was one woman. Now, she was a powerful woman. And she was a miserable woman, but it was the only one. And there are probably some other examples of his magnifying the negative, you know. And then minimizing the positive when he says, I alone am left. And the Lord said, no, no. 7,000 other folks haven't bowed the knee to Baal. Haven't bowed their knees to Baal. And by the way, don't forget about Obadiah. You know, that's why we took a little time for Obadiah. You know, Obadiah, yeah, he was different from you, Elijah. He didn't have quite that confrontational personality or ministry. But Obadiah was a faithful believer. Obadiah took his life in his hands by hiding those 100 prophets of the Lord in two different caves. And that was right under Jezebel's nose. So, no, you're not all alone. Everybody's not against you. It's not as bad as you think. But when we, not you, when we get down and we kind of give in to a moment of weakness, we tend then to skew our understanding of what is really good and what is really bad, and the bad kind of takes over, et cetera, et cetera. So what we see in our text then is a godly man who is caught in a moment of weakness. And it's a weakness in his area of strength, courage. And the reason or reasons for that weakness, there were plenty of them, but there was a physical element to it, and there was an emotional element to it, and there was a spiritual element to it. And I got to mention this. I've been thinking about this. I don't know where this fits, okay? I just try to get everything to fit nice, but it doesn't always fit nice. life doesn't always fit nice. You know, the true truth is that what we're seeing here is a reaction, not an action. And I have found in life, now he is reacting. He's reacting to this threat. Tomorrow, 24 hours, you're a dead man. Ah! React. I have discovered in life that it is much easier to control my actions than my reactions. My reactions are much more automatic, much more unthinking. And it is my reactions that I often end up regretting, saying, why did I say that? Why did I feel that way? Why did I do that? Why didn't I do that? And I'm looking much more at my reactions than my actions. And that's really what we're seeing here. This is a reaction. And that's scary. That is very, very scary. Okay, last point. That's not the end of the sermon. Don't get too happy. But it's the last point. How did God lift him out of this depression? What did God do anyway? And the true truth is, I'm not going to answer that question completely. We're coming back next Sunday night. So you can be depressed from now till Sunday night. But we can at least get started. How did God lift him? Well, we've already said that he put him to sleep for two good nights. And he fed him two good meals. And I alluded to that as the tenderness of God, that God understood the physical frame in which he was living. And the Lord did not take him to task and scold him, but he ministered to his physical need by sleep and by food, touched by an angel food, if you will, or whatever. That was part of it. That was part of God's ministering to him. He allowed him then to escape and to end up at Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb. And that I need to talk about that for just a moment. It doesn't seem initially to me, it did not seem all that important that he scrammed south and he went as far south as he could possibly go, which is the truth. 285 miles south to the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula. And it wasn't just that he was trying to get away as far as he could, at least it doesn't appear that way. You get the impression, the more you read about what's going on here and think about it, because there's nothing in the text that tells us, you know, why did you go there? It's not there. I wish it were there. But the impression that I have is that he went there because he sensed, notice that word, he sensed that he needed to go where God was. He sensed a need to go where God had shown up before. I can't prove that to you, but it appears that that was what was going on here. When you read the commentaries, they don't make a big deal of this, but they do keep drawing parallels between Elijah on the one hand and Moses on the other. When Moses fled Egypt, where did he go? Right there, Mount Sinai. And when he was there taking care of the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, what happened to Moses? God showed up in a burning bush. And he said essentially to Moses, I'm not done with you, Buster. Get on back to Egypt. I got some work for you to do. Oh. Guess what? Elijah fled not from Egypt, but from Israel. And he fled all the way there. And guess who showed up at Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai? God did. Now, Moses saw him initially in a burning bush. But remember what God said to Moses. Now, when you bring those people out from Egypt, I want you to bring them right here. Do you remember that? Do you know that? You know your Old Testament? And he says, now, when you bring them here, I'm going to come down on the mountain and I'm going to show myself to those folks. Did God do that? Oh, he sure did. He scared them spitless. I mean, there was earthquake and there was fire and there was wind and there was rain. And they're saying, ah, we're out of here. We can't take this. But that's God showed up. Now, what happened to Elijah when he got there to this mountain years later? God showed up. How? Fire, wind, earthquake. Oh. So you kind of have the idea that Elijah sensed that he needed something from God. And he was going to go where God was. Wow. Isn't that interesting, though? It's an interesting thought. Now, this is really the last thought. When you and I, when we are down, when we flub, I'm reading what I wrote, when we flub, when we fail, when we react poorly, run to, not away from God. You think about that. Run to him. I'm not talking about a physical location now, as they had here where God had shown up on the mountain. But we need to run to God, not away from God. I think when we run away from God, we're basically saying, you know, I'm afraid of you. Or maybe if we stare clear, he won't really ever know. We can kind of fool ourselves as though God doesn't know what's going on. I think it shows the trueness of our Christianity when we fail, and we know it. We don't try to hide it. We don't try to pretend. We don't try to stay as far away from God and his people and the Bible as we can, but rather in our brokenness and in our weakness and with a kind of a sad banana transparency, if I may say it that way, we run to him. We run to him. And you know, I think honestly, I thought about you this week. I think, you know, many of you are here on Sunday nights, running to God, not away from him. And I think that's beautiful. Elijah at least had enough sense, whether it was common sense or spiritual sense, I don't know. He at least had enough sense to run to the Lord and not away from him. Final thought. And I'm just going to read what I wrote. Since reactions are so hard for us to control, then we must become Bible and theology saturated to enable us to have automatic, correct reactions. May I say that again? Since reactions are so difficult for us to control, we must become Bible and theology saturated to enable automatic, correct responses. I don't know if I know the Bible that well. or if I know my theology that well. But that seems to me to be a wonderful goal. So that even in our reactions, which are much more automatic and unthinking, we respond in a Christ-like, God-honoring manner, even in times of weakness, when we are caught unawares and not prepared for what we just heard, but we still respond automatically in a biblical and God-honoring way. Wow. You think about that.